Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air. Tonight, we listen to your voicemails. Now, let's join Dan to discuss this week's episode, The Pursuit of Peace.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to Republic Forces Radio Network. We're here tonight to discuss Pursuit of Peace. Joining me this evening is Jen.
Hello.
Nathan P. Butler.
Hello, all.
And once again, Jerry has to do that job thing. So filling in for him on this final episode of this arc is Barrent.
Salutations!
All right, we are here to discuss Pursuit of Peace, episode 11 of Season 3, and our final episode of 2010. Yes, we're going to be taking a break for the next few weeks so everyone can enjoy the holidays.
But don't worry, we here at Republic Forces Radio Network aren't going to leave you hanging. We do also have Arnie and Marjorie's special report from the Savage Opress event in Chicago.
I'm going to be listening to the report with a little bit of Prince playing and be singing along, talking about this is what it sounds like when the continuity cries. I have much fear about the Night Sisters and Maul having a brother. The only thing I'm crossing my fingers is that we're going to hear Khmer Sarin as Darth Maul's real name again for the first time since the foreign translation that was cut from the English versions. I'm like, give us at least something positive while I'm sitting here pulling my hair out.
Hopefully it's not just going to be the original motion picture again and the preview that we've seen already, just on a big screen. So before we get going into our discussion, let's get a quick plot summary on Pursuit of Peace.
Once again, this is episode 11 of season 3, production order season 3, episode 7. The fortune cookie for this week, truth can strike down the specter of fear. We rejoin the Senate still debating the acquisition of new troops and the debt that would incur. Padme is still passionately opposing, calling for a stop to the fighting, and letting slip that she knows separatist senators who want the war to stop as well. This does not receive warm reception in the Senate. And is it in the heat of this argument that the Senate gets a voicemail?
Your Republic forces have carried out a barbaric attack on our people. And among the deaths was the very sponsor of the peace accord, Senator Mina Bonteri.
What? No!
With her needless death, I must formally withdraw the proposal for peace offered by our Senate.
In a private meeting, Padme, Bail, and Anaconda discuss how best to oppose this bill and what kind of information will give them the ammunition that they need.
We can't afford ammunition, remember? I joke.
After talking to the banking clan, Padme and Bail meet to discuss what they've learned. Bail informs Padme that some senators are being threatened so they will not oppose the banking deregulation. To prove this point, we see Anaconda Farr attacked by Cheta Hayoki and Robonino. The next day, Padme is still trying to sway her fellow senators. Fortunately, despite his severe beating, Anaconda is still on Padme's side. In a seedy bar in Coruscant, Cheta Hayoki and Robonino receive instructions from Count Dooku on how best to deal with Padme.
Take her out of the game.
Elsewhere, Padme asks Bail to speak to the Senate, as he's the best speaker she knows. When he agrees, Padme goes to visit those senators still undecided. In the home of Quarren Senator Christo, Padme pleads with him to think of the people dying because of the war. But Christo wants to know where Senator Organa stands on the issue.
I said I'll listen to what he has to say.
Outside Christo's apartment, Padme is attacked by Dooku's ruffians. However, the attack is interrupted by two police droids. Using their distraction as a chance to run for it, Padme steals a Twi'lek's bark speeder and is pursued by Jada Hoyta and Robonino, who have destroyed the police droids. After shaking the grappled Cellcath Chato off her speeder, Padme is stopped by police droids. However, they're not interested in her pleas.
Those bounty hunters were trying to kill me! I am a senator! I demand that you arrest them!
Get your hands in the air!
Back in her apartment, Padme speaks to Tekla about how the war is affecting her and her family as she's clean and bandaged from her encounter. Elsewhere, having failed to assassinate Padme, Chata Hayoki and Robonino attack Bail Organa in a parking garage. In the ensuing firefight between Bail's guards, police droids, and the bounty hunters, Bail is injured. Padme receives a message from Bail Organa that he is not going to be able to give his speech. As the Senate grows restless, Anaconda and Tekla encourage Padme to address the Senate in his stead. As the Senate prepares to vote without hearing from the opposition, Padme comes forward to give an impassioned speech that is broadcast throughout Coruscant. The undecided senators are swayed, and even her opposition are forced to give a respectful applause. Later, in Palpatine's office, he ponders the undoing of his machinations by one senator.
What do you plan to do about this?
For now, we must adhere to the principles of our democracy. We must let the wheels of the Senate turn.
All right. So before we get into our discussion, let's go around and get everyone's thoughts on the episode. And since Barrent is back after a little bit of a hiatus, let's start with him. Barrent, what did you think of Pursuit of Peace?
I thought it was all right. I'm looking at what we're actually getting in the Star Wars, the Clone Wars series, and what we've actually wanted to get. And it is what it is. You know, we're getting a lot of political, you know, I don't mind the political stuff so much, but it just seems like it's going on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, we want some Jedi. But then who's to say that if I was getting a lot of Jedi, I wouldn't say, you know, where are those Padme stories at? So I thought it was okay. I thought it was a well-written story. I thought the characters were good. I mean, we're having a lot of, you know, any story that has a lot of questions that could come up, because obviously this story is taking place in a storyline that has already been introduced in season two. So in that respect, it's always good to find out where it's going to fit and stuff like that. But we're going to talk about what's missing out of here. It's not a lot, but it's just missing the mark. And I think it's because maybe they have to spread these storylines out or something like that. They can't give us everything in every show. But it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. But, you know, it wasn't the best.
All right, Jen, how about you?
I'm with Barrent on this one. I was very kind of on the whole thing. There are parts of it that I really liked, and there are parts of it that I really thought were kind of crap. So this is kind of 50-50 episode for me. Kind of didn't hate it, didn't love it. Some of the character stuff I really liked. I like to see some of the new character designs. Robonino's little henchman buddy, armadillo guy, he was kind of cool. Just character design-wise, I didn't really like him as a person, but I liked seeing some of the stuff in the Senate. I'm one of the few people that doesn't mind the Senate stuff. I feel like it is kind of important. They're getting a little heavy-handed with it now. Like, she brought up healthcare, and I started twitching a little bit just because I feel like we can't get away from the healthcare reform stuff. Maybe that's just because I work in the field. But some of the stuff I really didn't like, though, like that whole speeder chase, I think because the sound effects and everything were so reminiscent of Episode 2, that scene in Episode 2 is probably the single scene I hate most of the Star Wars. Like, I can't watch it. And so when that started going, I was zoning out. I just couldn't stand that scene. But it wasn't a bad episode overall. I feel like it had probably more positives than negatives, but not my favorite.
All right. Nathan P.
I think really of the political episodes, this is probably my favorite, or one of maybe my top two or so political episodes in this series. It's pacing kind of varies because we do have the speeder bike chase in the middle, although it does seem, listening to Filoni's commentary on StarWars.com, a little video commentary, that it was sort of an afterthought to give it better pacing. But I think the issues that were involved were a little more realistic. They didn't try to dumb it down for kids. I figure it's kind of one of those things. Like, I'm constantly thinking of the fact that kids aren't necessarily going to understand a lot of the political discussion in here, and I talked about that last time around, about, you know, at what point do we get to the point where we're sort of preaching to the kids. On the other hand, at least this time when they did the political stuff, it had enough complexity to feel as though maybe these really were adults talking. And yeah, maybe the kids in the audience won't get it, but at the same time, the adults in the audience won't sit there thinking, how much are you going to dumb this down to make it this weird middle ground of politics? Give us something at least a little more complex. And this dealt with other issues. It introduced the idea of the Republic providing social services on various planets. Granted, it sort of beats us over the head with modern politics again. But I think the way it was handled was a little more mature, a little more well done. We get fun little moments here and there. And from a continuity standpoint, it didn't drop a bomb on anything. So, I don't know. Overall, for an episode with no Anakin, no Obi-Wan, no Ahsoka, no major Jedi action or anything like that, that is overloaded with politics, overall, this one stands out as probably one of those favorites of mine. It's never going to stand up against some of the better action episodes, but for a political episode, it was pretty up there for me.
Thank you, Nathan. I actually have to kind of agree with Nathan. I didn't hate this episode. I kind of enjoyed it, even though it was politics, and I'm, as I stated last episode, more of a show me flashy things, blowing up action. I have a limited attention span, but this one I actually enjoyed, the political intrigue and that they were blatantly beating the devil out of senators to threaten them not to vote for this or vote against this proposition. I really liked, and seeing Padme have to step up and her be the voice for the resistance against furthering the war, that kind of made some things clear as far as we see in episode 3, where she is the main voice and it's not so much Bail. So I really like this episode, and visually it was very impressive. Some of the scenes, especially during Padme's speech when they were just panning all through Coruscant, I really thought that it looked great. Some of the better visuals of this season were at work in this episode. All right, so let's jump right into it. Right off the bat, we're dropping bombs, as Nathan said. We get to the Senate and they're hotly debating where we left them last episode, the purchase of more clones. Padme stands up to dispute and Palpatine plays their latest voicemail from Count Dooku, and we find out that Mina is dead.
What gets me about this is not that she died, although honestly I think this was a character who could be a real asset to the series. I kind of hope she's not dead. I hope it's more like she's been captured, she's being tortured or something, so she can show up later, because she made a great counterpoint to Padme and really seemed like one of the more intriguing aspects introduced in Heroes on Both Sides. And now we find out that, well, the hero on that side, yeah, she's dead. Supposedly killed by the Republic, presumably probably just killed by Dooku. But the fact that they did it off-screen irks me. Now, granted, in this series, off-screen may just mean wait until season 4 and we'll see an episode that shows it. But at this point, this is an off-screen death. If we didn't have a couple of sentences showing up in this episode, we wouldn't know she's dead. It sets up really cool things, possibly great potential, for the next time we see her son, Lux Bonteri. Even the StarWars.com episode guide mentions, hey, it'll be interesting the next time we see Lux, given what happens in this episode, or something along those lines, especially given his flirtation with Ahsoka. But I gotta say, having her killed off-screen rather than on-screen felt cheap to me. It felt unexpected, so they certainly surprised me, but at the same time, it really kind of felt cheap, and I wonder if this is an episode in our future, or if this is just one of those things where they needed the plot point, and they wanted to just toss it in there and get moving with the rest of the story, so there it is, and we'll never get more to it.
You know, I wasn't on last week's episode when she premiered, and I really liked her character. I really liked the tattoos that they gave her. I liked the fact that she was a separatist that Padme had known, and I liked the fact that she was human, because up to this point, all the separatists we've seen are Geonosians or they're robots or something like that. You know, we don't see too many separatist humans. And I like the fact that she was a separatist unit, that she was trying for peace. You know, even in the dirtiest wars that we have, and we're in a couple dirty wars now, there's people over there who want peace. You know, there's people in power who want peace. You know, they don't want to keep fighting. You know, they're strong people and they got to do what they have to do to protect themselves, but they don't want to keep fighting. And I thought that she was a great character and she had so much potential. You know, she was someone that I felt that could really have some really great storylines in the future when it comes to Padme and getting information back and forth, maybe an underground railroad between the two. You know, I was having all of these potential storylines that could happen and they just cut it off. So it was kind of disappointing.
This, her death was one of the things that really bothered me about this episode. I know that, like, in real life, people just get killed, and that's how real life happens. This kind of thing probably isn't unheard of in the wars that we've been fighting. But in art and literature and any kind of entertainment type thing, I'm a firm believer in not wasting a character's death. Like, I understand that characters need to die, and I can actually enjoy character deaths in certain circumstances. But I felt like this character, we just got her, and she had so much potential. And I was fairly certain that she was going to die at some point in this series, just because the Separatists can't sue for peace at some point. So, but the fact that she's killed, not only off screen, but with no real, there was no event, there was no like bombing, there was nothing. She just was like, oh, and by the way, someone sniped her. And that bothered me. It felt like a waste of her character. I feel like it could have been somebody else. It could have been like, you know, some child was murdered or something. I don't know. It just bothered me. I felt like it was a waste of the character. And I felt like now the only way we can see her do anything is a flashback, which is, again, not really as good of a use of the character, I feel.
I'm right with you there, Jen. I didn't necessarily look at it entirely from that point of view, but I just looked at it from the, here's, they tell us how hard it is and how expensive it is and takes so long to build a character model. They use her for one episode and then they kill her. And they don't kill her in a newsreel like they show us every single other thing that they don't want to waste an episode on, or they don't want to waste an episode right now on. They just mention it. I have to wonder if maybe she's going to show up later. They try to get her. She escaped. Her and Lux are on the run. She's trying to go Republic. I have to wonder, really, if she is gone. I expected her to not survive the series, but to not survive two episodes, or at least even the entire arc, that was a little surprising.
You know, even thinking of what Jen just said about how she could appear in flashback episodes. Well, she could, but not really. Because we go straight from Heroes on Both Sides to this, to Senate Murders. It's the latest in the continuity that we've seen thus far, at least within this series here. And Padme hadn't seen her since the beginning of the war. And Ahsoka had never met them before. So yeah, we could maybe see episodes with her character, assuming she really is dead. We could see episodes with her character perhaps set between Heroes on Both Sides and this. That would be a real weird sandwiching in. Or maybe before Heroes on Both Sides. But it wouldn't be able to have that same dynamic with Padme or with Ahsoka being there, because they never met up to that point. She and Ahsoka hadn't. Padme hadn't seen her in ages. It seems as though we'd have to have some kind of Separatist behind the lines type of episode in order to make that happen. And given how much the focus has been on heroic characters, even when the characters have been just clones rather than our mainstay characters, I don't see them doing that.
Okay, so the Senate has, I guess, recessed to before they make a vote, and Padme and Bail are going to rally some support for their cause. So Bail, Padme, and Anaconda are off trying to rally support for their cause. Meanwhile, we find out that senators are being beaten and threatened to prevent them from voting along with this resistance group. We go to a cantina where we see Dooku providing the orders for this, and this is where we first meet the Cellcath, and we see the return of Robonino. This, I felt, was kind of a little bit of a seedy scene, just because, not necessarily because they were in a bar, but the Twi'lek dancing, this is one of the things that, once again, this season, we seem to be making this more of a preteen, early teen show, not so much for the little kids. Am I just reading too much into this as a parent? Barrett, you're a parent. How did you feel about that? Did you feel that was a little bit, for the littler ones?
To tell you the truth, by this time, my son was long gone. I mean, he was having nothing to do with this episode.
But I think what got me about this particular scene is that it really did feel sort of like the old style, like, it's like a Star Wars gangster movie kind of thing, you know? I like the fact that Dooku is contacting them for the job while they're already there. They're in the seedy establishment. We know it's seedy because of the color schemes, and it's sort of like a cantina thing, and you've got the dancing girl and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, they're kind of sitting there thinking, you know, should we beat her up too? And like, nope, something better is called for. And, you know, now they're like, yes, they're almost like giddy that they actually get to kill her this time, as opposed to just beating her up like everybody else. The only place where the whole thing kind of fell apart for me was it sort of felt like kind of an old gangster movie type thing. And what I wanted to see was, and neither of these characters really fit the bill for it physically, but I wanted to see a senator standing up to one of these guys and have Robonino or Chatahoyoki, the Cellcath, be standing there with basically like a little billy club type thing going, you know why, I'm not sure you should vote for this appropriation the way that Padme wants you to. You know, if somebody could get hurt, you know what I'm saying? I would have loved to see something like that. Play it up even more. But they didn't. But I think just the fact that they allowed it to go that far into the sort of seedy establishment thing and gave us that vibe, I think that bodes well for the future. I'd love to see more of like a gangster-style story. Because they've done stories in other genres. I mean, they've done the monster movie type stuff and that sort of thing, the Seven Samurai type of thing. Give us like a gangster story in this case. Like not a hut gangster, but like a real sort of 1930s or mob enforcer modern day kind of story. That'd be awesome.
I like the feel that Dooku is giving his instructions over, a comm where it's a hologram, and that it's kind of like how, you know, the Emperor likes to give a lot of his orders over the hologram, not in person. And Dooku was really giving off an Emperor-like feel, you know, like he could actually be controlling some things, you know, because before Dooku has always been kind of a failure. He hasn't really, none of his plans kind of come together. None of the people like Asajj that he sends out to do his bidding are never getting the job done. He's always disappointed. And, you know, here, Dooku's pulling the strings, and one of his plans actually goes through to fruition. And it's great. It's great to see that. That's the Dooku that I want to see, the in-command. You know, he could be the Emperor because he's the Emperor's apprentice right now, right? And the way the dark side work is you have one who has the power and one to crave the power. So the apprentice is always trying to, you know, gain the power from its master. So I like seeing this side of Dooku.
All right. So our two nefarious bounty hunters get their marching orders from Dooku, and they're instructed to do something more permanent than what they've done to the other senators, to Padme, which leads us to Padme's meeting with the Quarren senator and the fabulous speeder chase, which was visually impressive, but the sounds were kind of like, as Jen brought out, the speeder chase from episode 2 with some sound effects from Return of the Jedi thrown in. They didn't really go out on a limb with anything new in the audio department there.
The speeder chase felt really like, I didn't watch the Dave Filoni thing, so I didn't get that information until just now, but it really did feel like an afterthought. It felt like someone said, like someone was watching the preview, or someone was going over the storyboards and was like, you know, the kids are going to be bored. We should put in some sort of action in here. And the speeder chase itself wasn't even what bothered me. It was that there were no repercussions from it. And I think the commercial breaks are the same for everybody. We get to the commercial break, Padme is basically getting arrested, and then we come back from the break and she's fine. And I know, like, for timing purposes, we can't really get into that, but it just struck me as really odd that they would end it right there, imply that there was going to be some sort of legal issue, and then just nothing. That bugged me. It really annoyed me. I thought maybe we were going to see her have to go to prison or have to get bailed out or something like that. It just was really jarring to have it be basically pointless. There was no reason for it. So not my favorite scene. The rest of this episode I really didn't mind, but this really hurt it for me.
I spent part of last night, as of the time we're recording this, watching that recent Tom Cruise, Cameron Diaz movie, Night and Day. And they do a lot of that sort of thing where they end the scene and they jump ahead and they leave the issue of filling in the blanks of what happened in between up to the viewer, because it's kind of obvious what leads you from one scene to another. But from a pacing standpoint, to make the movie just kind of keep on going at a nice clip, they've got to do that sort of thing. I kind of felt the same way about this scene. In fact, I was reminded of this scene while watching that movie, thinking, well, you know, that's kind of a jump, like what we saw with Clone Wars. But moreover, what we see in Clone Wars a lot of the time, because in the Clone Wars, with them having such a short amount of time, it feels like a lot of times we bounce from one scene to the next, and anything that can be assumed in between is cut, because otherwise you wouldn't have time for all the political banter and discussion for that particular episode. For the speeder chase itself, or for the speeder bike quasi chase itself, I actually really liked it, because I think it wasn't overplayed. Yeah, the sound effects were pretty much sound effects we'd heard before, but that's what Star Wars is. I mean, Star Wars sounds a lot of time are reused. I mean, how many times can we hear R2-D2 beep the exact same way he did in the films? That's not a big surprise or a big quibble with me. But I was fearing the fact that somehow Padme would become some kind of like super demolition derby type driver and just be doing all kinds of amazing stuff during this chase that would make it really unrealistic for the character. But she really doesn't do that. She doesn't do a lot of fancy moves. It's more like, how can I drive in such a way that the person hanging off the back of my speeder is going to be splattered into something? It seemed a lot more realistic for her character than I ever would have given them credit for doing within the series. It didn't throw me out of the episode. Now, it does now that I watch it a second time, and I know that Filoni has now said it was basically added in there for pacing's sake, that it was sort of an afterthought. Yeah, now it kind of bugs me that it's in there. But just from the standpoint of watching it for the very first time, and nothing threw me out of it. In fact, it was probably one of the more engaging chase scenes of the series so far for me.
It was a great scene as far as the way that the camera angles and the way it was paced. And, you know, I mean, who wouldn't want a Padme with soft good skirt on her own speeder bike dragging a bounty hunter? You know, that's a battle pack if I ever seen one. And, you know, I was watching the scene, and I didn't read Filoni's comments, so I didn't know that this was an afterthought. And so it didn't come across to me as an afterthought. It came across to me as a great scene as far as action goes. I mean, there's little things in that scene where, you know, right before Padme drags the bounty hunter into the box, you know, she kind of does a smirk like, you know, I'm going to do this. And, you know, when they're speeding by on Coruscant and they speed by the second police officers, you know, one of the police officers spills his coffee on his chest. You know, why a robot is drinking coffee, or it's oil, or I don't know what it was, but it was kind of funny, you know, and it was just like a quick second. So the speeder chase was a chance for the animators to kind of spread their wings, you know, and they kind of showing us what they caught. You know, they haven't lost it. You know, we can still give you the space battle, you know, type of thing. And I like that they put it in there. It was a welcome change of pace to watching Bail Organa walk around with his swagger.
You know, I'll add above and beyond that, that I would rather watch this scene over again than watch the speeder chase scene at the beginning of Attack of the Clones again, or watch the pod race scene again. Those two left me feeling like I was lacking something, just kind of sitting there shaking my head, wishing that the things would speed themselves along. This one didn't. I don't know if it's because it's animated or the context around it, but I much prefer this scene to the couple of chase scenes that we saw in the prequels.
You know, Brent, I know that you go through these episodes looking for opportunities for Hasbro to make a figure. But in that case, I agree with you. If they were to make and I believe that they will make a battle pack of that chase scene, and that is one I will definitely want. Padme on her Bark speeder dragging a Cellcath with Ronanino and his little miniature speeder bike. That would be a great pack. I would enjoy that. So Padme gets home, finds out that, well, she doesn't find this out at home. She gets to the Senate after her meeting and finds out that after her attack, that Bail had the tar beat out of him and he's not going to be able to make it. So nervous Padme isn't sure what to do. She's talked to her maid. We've seen her in another new outfit this episode. And then we see her preparing to be addressed to Senate, and we find out that her hair is fake. Makes you wonder a whole lot about the outfits from episodes 1, 2. Did she change her hair very much in 3? But 1 and 2 especially. She's in the Senate and a lot in 1 when she's got that really big handlebar hair.
You know what got me about it was it wasn't the, oh, her hair tends to be these wigs or these really sculpted wigs, because you notice the wig they were going to put on her head, oh, that thing did not move at all. It was basically a helmet, which makes me kind of wonder if the thing that she was wearing while she was driving the speeder bike, because, hey, you know, safety first, if that weirdly shaped swooping forward thing was possibly a helmet too. But my first thought was, okay, so that's a wig that looks kind of like a helmet, but you don't see the rest of her hair while she's wearing it. So the rest of her natural hair is a nasty, nappy, sweaty mess plugged in underneath that helmet. There's got to be some funk going on underneath those helmets or wigs.
The wig thing freaked me out, actually, because she's just holding it. The aide is just holding it really casually. And she's kind of like, whoa, that's really creepy, because it looks like they just cut the top of her character model off and just put it in the character's hands. But kind of what you were talking about, Nathan, that made me wonder, too. I have really long hair. And so I was thinking, like, where does she put it? Does she have to, like, kind of coil it into, like, these braid things? Like, that must really be uncomfortable. Like, I don't know how she would go about doing that and why she would bother when she has so much hair. And she could, I don't know, just very odd that they chose to do that.
I want to see Anakin cheering her up after a bad Senate vote, coming in wearing one of her wigs. I mean, now that we know they're wigs, come on. Just chop the character model piece off and stick it on Anakin. Have him walk in like, hey, how do I look, honey? Or something like that. I would say Ahsoka, but her head tails would get in the way. But Anakin makes a good one. Or on the previously so stoic Obi-Wan, you know, how do you like it, my dear? That would work.
See, Jen brings up a point that I want to see in the deleted scenes or the extra features of season 3. Because you know that the hair itself isn't a separate character model. That's Padme's head. So when you pull back on that shot, I'm sure that she is indeed holding Padme's head. All right, so Padme has to give Bail's speech. And this, I felt that she actually shined. She took the comments that were made by her assistant there, and she used them to sway the Senate. And she brought the senators who were up in arms against her around. She even managed to get respectful applause from her opponents in the vote. This was really pushing Padme to the point of political leadership that she is in that group that we see her in episode 3.
I love this scene. This is probably what made this episode for me, because I've been wanting forever to see Padme be able to really get in and do some really good political work, because she has this, she's always talking about diplomacy and talking with people, and we don't get to see her do it that much, or we don't get to see her succeed at it that much. And so getting to see her make this really impassioned speech and having it work was really cool. And I liked that they were kind of showing the different scenes across Coruscant and broadcasting it and having the people kind of glancing up and taking notice. I loved that scene. It really, really worked.
You know, the speech was really well done, and I think it probably was more personal than any kind of speech that Bail Organa would have given. Although it would be kind of cool to see another speech done by Bail Organa, because that's a character who is also sort of the diplomat who's talked up so much that we could probably stand to see a little more of in that realm, as opposed to being the quasi-action hero who, you know, crashes his speeder and gets his butt kicked in this particular episode. But there was sort of an insincerity going into that speech, as much as it seemed as though she really believed what she was saying. Here I am watching the episode, and what beats did we have in this whole idea of how the speech was going to turn out? We had the comments about, you know, when was the last time you talked to your people? And that sort of thing, giving the impression that the Senate is effectively cut off, because they're on Coruscant, from the troubles of the real people back home. Then she's talking with her handmaiden, who was a servant back in episode 2, which we'll get into in Continuity Corner. But she's talking to Tekla, and it's like Tekla mentions something, and here Padme is just like, hey, I've got an idea for my speech. Tekla, tell me about the people back home. And then she uses it in her speech. It felt like she was using Tekla to get the information for the better speech. It really didn't feel to me like she really gave a crap. Or if she did give a crap, she didn't think to ask and actively give a crap until she thought, hey, this could work for a way of giving my speech. It's like until she was rebuked for it, or thought it could be a speech idea perhaps, she wouldn't have bothered asking, how are things back home? How are things with your family? It seemed like it was something that if it had been done without that previous scene, it would have felt very genuine. But with that previous scene in there about, well, how much do you contact people back home, or whatever it was said, it really felt, if not insincere, then at least contrived. It felt that she really was telling a story that wasn't something she gleaned just from her personal experience with her handmaiden and friend, but of information that she dug through to give the speech. It's like in, and Saturday Night Live did a great joke on this constantly. During the presidential debates back in 2000, they had a great thing with Daryl Hammond, I think it was, playing Al Gore. And his thing was always, we're talking about Social Security, and we need to worry about this is Myrtle from Florida. She is 92, and he just goes on and on and on and on. And you know he doesn't know the person. It's just people that were researched by his campaign staff and used. Politicians do it all the time. I was hoping Padme wasn't one of those politicians. This episode played into the notion that she's just like any other one. And that didn't work for me in context with what's supposed to be this big, stirring speech.
Now, that actually did work for me, because I felt that the Quorn saying that kind of reminded Padme she has maybe lost a little bit of touch. She's become so focused on opposing this war, she didn't remember exactly why she was opposing this war. So hearing her aide there speak up reminded her, hey, he's right. Maybe I don't know. Maybe I should find out what is going on so I really know what I'm fighting for. So
but if
I'm
that's
probably giving them too much credit and reading too much in.
No, but if that's the case, though, if she really did need reminding, then doesn't that turn around and retroactively add insincerity to at least, or at least less altruistic motives, perhaps, to some of the stuff that Padme's been doing for the rest of the series thus far? Because we always get the sense that she's working on the side of the people, on the side of her constituents, on the side of those who want the war to end because of how they're suffering and blah, blah, blah. But if it takes the Quarren, I think it was Christo was the guy's name, if it takes the Quarren to remind her of that in this episode, then what the heck has she been fighting for the entire rest of the series? Unless we're to assume that in the intervening, whatever the time gap was between the previous episodes and Heroes on Both Sides, when we jumped forward in character models and time, that somewhere in that gap, she lost sight. But I don't know, either way, just whichever way you look at it in context, to me, it didn't quite work. If only they had not included the scene of, well, when was the last time you... If they had left that out, I think it would have played a little bit better. And we would have gotten to see maybe a little bit more characterization of some of the other senators getting beat up, maybe a little more with Anna Kandahar and his bad jokes, which I actually found kind of amusing, because how many times do we see, you know, a crickets type of joke told in a Star Wars episode? You know, it didn't work. To me, it was a missed opportunity because it could have been much better than it was. Effective, yes. As effective as it could have been, no.
I was going to say, you only get those kind of jokes here. I think Padme and the other senators are obviously not connected to their constituents. I mean, they're having these dinners, these luxurious dinners. They have servants. I mean, when you're living a life like that, you know, you're not thinking about, you know, the person who has to have two or three jobs, you know, or you're not thinking about the Twi'lek who has to dance on the table, you know, to make ends meet. So I think she's been kind of disconnected for a lot of it, a lot of the time. And I find it refreshing that she's willing to use these tactics. She's willing to use a poor person and her family in order to get her point across, because, you know, in politics, you have to fight dirty. And I just kept thinking that, you know, as soon as Anakin hears how she used this poor woman's story, he's going to be like, yeah, you know, that's my girl. You know, that's a little bit of the dark side coming out of her. But she was using it for good.
But you agree. You know? But you agree that it was a tactic. It was okay. She used Tekla. Not she shared Tekla's story as a good example of what people should be concerned about. She used her. You said it in one sentence. Used and tactic.
I totally agree that she used it in a tactic. But the difference between us is that I like that she did that.
Oh, I think it worked.
That didn't take away. That did not take away from the Padme that I know. It actually added to the Padme that I know that she could be a cunning diplomat and use all of her knowledge around her at her disposal.
You don't think that diminishes the character by making her less altruistic?
No, I don't. Because war tarnishes everyone. I, you know, no matter who you are, you could be, you know, you could be Obi-Wan Kenobi. You could be anyone. You could be Yoda. You could be anybody who has lived on the right side. And as soon as you get involved in the war, it will tarnish you. So no, not for me, it doesn't.
Okay, I'll go with it.
All right, before we spur this poor horse to death, Jen?
I think it's kind of, with Padme's usage of it, I think it's more that she got a little bit of a slap in the face, kind of like what Barrett was saying. It's kind of like when, like during the holidays, you get the Salvation Army guys out there ringing the bells, and you kind of remember that there are people who have less than you do, who have things really worse off, and you kind of have this moment of, you know, hey, I'm not being, you know, as generous or as good with my cause as I should be. Or like in her case, I think that there's so much politics and that they're in the Senate all the time. And she's so immersed in this political aspect of the war that she has probably lost touch a bit with her people. And, you know, war slows down traffic. It slows down communications. She probably hasn't gone home in months, if not years. I can see how she could still be very positive on the cause and still be trying as hard as she can while still losing touch with it. And then she gets this slap in the face from the Quarren and kind of says, you know, yes, I do need to talk to my people. And hearing this, like, I feel very impassioned by this. These other people, I can maybe spark that same thing in them. I don't think it was necessarily this dark political manipulation only. I think she was just using the tools that came to hand, and she is a politician, so that's where her arena is.
Okay. So Padme makes her speech, and as we said, gets very popular reception. Our final scene takes place in Palpatine's office, where we see probably the most blatant evidence that he is the true machinations behind this. I mean, we do realize, of course, we've all seen episode 3, and original trilogy, we know he is the source of all evil. But this is the first time in a prequel, pre-Revenge of the Sith setting where we see him just flat out, I'm trying to make the world end.
Well, no, because we did see, I mean, didn't we see sort of a hint of that in the Zillow Beast episodes? Whenever he's saying, you know, we'll kill it and just get me the weapon. Now we're going to clone it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, weren't his actions there the more overtly evil? I mean, I agree. This is the first time, I guess, in this season. It's one of the few times in the series we get to actually see him as sort of evil Sidious without the cloak on. But I don't think it's our first time seeing it in the series, is it?
Well, I didn't necessarily mean him being evil. Yes, him and the Zillow Beast, where he was wanting to kill it and then make a weapon from it and then wanting to clone it at the end. That was pure disregard for everybody else evil. In this case, where we're actually seeing that he was involved in all of this. He stirred up this whole pot of nasty in the Senate. I thought this was pretty groundbreaking stuff. This is something that George never, I mean, we never saw a private meeting in episode one or two where him and Mos Amita were kind of elbowing each other saying, yeah, this is it.
I thought it was interesting that Mos Amita's in on it, because for some reason that never occurred to me. I thought Palpatine would be manipulating Mos Amita just as much as everybody else, and nobody knew his true plan except maybe those red guards that Yoda knocks out at the end of it, of episode three. But did that surprise you guys?
Well, you know, Nathan, to your point, in the Zillow Beast, we did kind of see him acting as Sidious that, you know, take the beast and we will clone it. Or I can't remember what he said, but they were going to basically clone the beast, you know, he told the doctor. So we've seen kind of the Sidious. The difference here, though, is when we see Palpatine, he's sitting in his throne. That is Sith Lord. You know, when he's sitting in his throne and you see him turn and he's looking over Coruscant, you know, it's kind of like reminiscent of when he's in Return of the Jedi, and he's sitting in his throne, and he's looking out over the space battle, and you really got the sense of Sidious. You know, this is not the first time. It really felt like the first time that we're actually seeing him, because he's more relaxed. He's actually Sidious without the cloak. He's talking to Mos Amita, and for me, this puts Mos Amita up there as, you know, being really, really evil. I mean, I know he's in episode three, you know, he's part of the, you know, he's right-hand man, but I mean, how long has Mos Amita known? You know, this goes back, how long has he known from day one? It really makes his character a little bit more interesting.
Well, from an EU standpoint, Mos Amita has essentially known about it since Outbound Flight, which was, you know, we don't know exactly which year in which the Clone Wars, this particular story is taking place, but about 5 years before the outbreak of the Clone Wars, he's revealing his true nature to Mos Amita, who at one point had been seen as a potential political rival. And Amita is okay with this. Amita is with him as it goes along. So essentially, he's one of the few people who will keep that secret for Palpatine. I was surprised to see them actually use that in the series. I would have expected them, when it came to Mos Amita, to not play on the, well, he knows the truth, but instead play him as ignorant and have to do some retcons to say, well, his mind was wiped at some point or something like that. But to see them consistent with the EU on that one, I was impressed. Whether it was intentional or not, I was still impressed.
Yeah, I always kind of thought Mos Amita was in on it, particularly because when Yoda showed up in Revenge of the Sith, he was kind of like, well, things are going to go bad. I should leave now. Kind of like he knew why Yoda was there and why things were going to get nasty. So I kind of took it as he always knew.
You know, I like the fact that they added that scene, which is one of my favorite scenes in the episode. Palpatine is talking to Mos Amita about this whole situation. Of course, Mos Amita knows kind of where he's going. Mos Amita is one of the few who understands the true nature of Palpatine, has essentially pledged allegiance to him. And we see Palpatine sort of doing his evil machinations behind the scenes, like, well, it's going to go the way we planned and blah, 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 that sort of thing. It's nice to see that as a counterpoint to Dooku's scene in the bar. Because it seems like a lot of times when Dooku fails, it's sort of like Palpatine has sort of given him his marching orders, but he either goes off the reservation and does his own thing, or he has sort of vague instructions and winds up having one of his underlings screw it up, that sort of thing. Whereas in this case, it really felt like the Sith were in line. Palpatine or Sidious wants it done. Dooku slash Tyrannus gets the contractors to get it done. And they're in the process of getting it done until the heroes interfere. There's no real incompetence along the way, and there's definitely a unified feeling that this command comes from the top and made its way down and almost went through had it not been for that meddling senator from Naboo.
So all in all, I felt that this was a very visually striking episode. I feel that we got to see Coruscant kind of in a different way than we've seen it before. We saw the seedy hotspot. We saw the alleyways and streets, which we have seen. But then we kind of saw in the scene of Padme's speech, we saw an overview and a flyby of a lot of like the public square and a lot of other places that made this very visually dynamic for me.
Yeah, I actually thought this episode was one of the better looking episodes that we've seen, at least as far as ones that were focusing on the main Jedi characters. Bail Organa seemed very well animated this time around. Padme's facial animation seemed to continuously be improved, or at least be improved over last season. Maybe I'm just noticing it more and more. It seemed like, from that standpoint, it was well done. But then also you've got these really nice interior scenes, sometimes with stuff happening outside the windows. It worked really, really well. It seems as though Coruscant, in a sense, has gotten a facelift this season, and this episode really is showing that off. I gotta wonder, though, how jarring the visuals will be to go back and watch Heroes on Both Sides, which introduced new character models, and then this episode, which was so nice-looking on Coruscant, and then watch Senate Murders, which was produced last season, granted a step up from the previous season, but certainly not quite to the level of this season, whether or not that's going to be an issue trying to watch those, especially because unlike some of the other ones that we saw that are sort of episodes connecting to previous ones, like, say, with Rookies connecting to other episodes, it's not just characters carrying over. In this case, it really is almost the exact same locations being carried over between this episode and Senate Murders. And, you know, it's just not the same visual quality. It's up the ante from last season.
All right, well, it's time now for Nathan P. Butler's Continuity Corner.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Continuity Corner. This week's episode, of course, is currently the second latest that we've seen thus far in the 3-year stretch of the Clone Wars era. And I mean 3 chronological years here, not 3 seasons. It makes up the second part of the trilogy with Heroes on Both Sides, Pursuit of Peace, and Senate Murders. As part of that trilogy, it's no surprise that we see Halle Bertoni here, who appears briefly in Heroes on Both Sides and reappears in Senate Murders, along with the vampire-esque Mee Deechee, who appears here and prominently in Senate Murders, but not in Heroes on Both Sides. Remember, though, that we're also told that the appearance of Senator Aang in Evil Plans was meant to set up the idea that Padme needs his support for the bills discussed in Senate Murders. Thus, it makes perfect sense that we see him again in this episode. Anakonda Farr appears, of course, along with his treacherous aide from Senate Murders, Lolo Purrs. Interestingly, even though so many characters have reappeared within this trilogy that was aired in 2 different seasons, it's the Banking Clan representatives that do not. In Heroes on Both Sides, the Mun that acted as the Banking Clan representative was Nix Card. Here, it's Mac Plain, or Make Plain. No reason is given for any type of switch in power, so we have to just assume that they're both representatives of the Banking Clan on Coruscant, unless something is taking place we just don't know about. This episode also introduces, alongside Mac Plain, the Selkath bounty hunter Chata Hoyoki, the Quarren Christo, and Padme's driver, Hogan Tenmar. Speaking of Hoyoki, chronologically the last we saw of his little partner here, Robo Nino, he was trying to escape after the events of Hostage Crisis and was captured on Rodia by Kit Fisto in the Hunting the Hunters Part 2 web strip and its accompanying game, Swamp Station Sweep, on StarWars.com. How he's now out and about free is an untold story thus far, assuming the comic story even exists anymore. Many have also commented about Padme's supposedly new handmaiden, but Tecla Manao is not a new character. She was a servant in Attack of the Clones, whose first name was revealed in the script. Tecla, another character, an extra played by Nathan Hamill, was unofficially named by the actor Raytul Manao. Later, when StarWars.com ran the What's the Story contest, where fans could create databank entries on unexplained characters and vehicles, a fan named Evan Berger created a backstory for the two that linked them together as brother and sister. This gave Tecla the last name Manao, expanding on the script's first name, and gave Hamill's character his name officially, rather than just in unofficial musings from Hamill himself. Speaking of the What's the Story entries, another shows up here. Fellow Solosound.net Star Wars podcaster William Devereaux created the backstory for Bail Organa's Narglach AirTech XJ2 airspeeder during the What's the Story contest. For those who follow him on Twitter, his exasperation when his speeder crashed was rather amusing. Now I just want my own What's the Story vehicle that appeared in Revenge of the Sith to show up in the series as well. Come on, Filoni! One other issue raised by some fans for this episode was the question of whether a Sel-Kath bounty hunter like Chata Hoyoki makes sense in the saga's continuity, given how they were portrayed previously in the Knights of the Old Republic era and elsewhere. The backstory previously established made their homeworld of Manan important because of its Bacta-like substance called Colto, but the use of Colto slowly gave way to Bacta from elsewhere, which caused Sel-Kath society, which had always tried to be neutral, to not only decline in importance, but also find itself essentially outside the lines of Republic society. Most fans then point out that the next major time we see the Sel-Kath is when the Empire conquers their degraded, more primitive society, which would have to be after the era of this episode. This seems to suggest that the Sel-Kath were essentially neutral outcasts with little importance, so maybe the character we see is an aberration. That may be true, perhaps, but we should also remember what most of these fans are forgetting. There was a Sel-Kath Jedi in the Clone Wars, so there are obviously at least some Sel-Kath out and about in the galaxy, including within the Republic and presumably even on Coruscant, given the location of the Jedi Temple there. In other words, think of it as an homage to the Knights of the Old Republic video games that were such hits, not as a continuity error, because it doesn't appear to be the latter. We've also received several hints of things to come just in the last week or so. In the StarWars.com episode guide, a comment is made that it will be very interesting the next time we see Lux Bonteri from Heroes on Both Sides, now that his mother has been killed, supposedly by the Republic, off-screen. And on his Twitter, Leland Chi has also called the episodes that resume in 2011 Season 3.5, giving them a distinct feel, noting that they include Ventress Dooku, issues about the Chosen One, and episodes in generally chronological order. Of course, we also have Savage Tarjay Opress and the Night Sisters on the way as well, so we have quite an interesting back half of the season on its way, it seems. And that, barring any further questions, closes out Continuity Corner this time around.
All right, thanks, Nathan. Now, we do have one voicemail this week from Glenn. We apologize to everybody who tried to get through but couldn't. We did have a slight technical difficulty with our Skype system, but that is all fixed now. So with the next episode, we will be able to receive your voicemails and air them on the show. Let's hear what Glenn had to say.
Hey, this is Glenn, and I am calling in with my thoughts on The Pursuit of Peace. I apologize if this goes a little long, but I think my third point that I'm going to get to will sort of blow your mind. I like this episode for a number of reasons, sort of three reasons. One, I think this is the best sort of prequel episode we've had because it really sort of lays a lot of the groundwork for Senate Murders. In the roundtable for Senate Murders, we had two major points of contention with the politics that they presented. One was that Republic negotiations with the separatists, you know, how does that work? You know, has that ever happened? Whatever. And now that's been covered in these two lead-up episodes and breaking down, particularly in this episode. And sort of unfortunately, however, they did not cover the issue of how one actually ramps up clone production, but we can sort of leave that. There's another minor point was that, you know, Anakin Afar was the only senator who had an aide in Senate Murders. At least now we can see here that Padme also has an aide, and even though she's not president in Senate Murders, it sort of makes the fact that, you know, Lolo doesn't stand out quite as much as, with Anakin Afar having an aide. You know, we know that some of the other senators also have aides, even if not present in that episode. And then the third thing, really, the main kicker, is that I totally now understand the whole prequel era. And, you know, I've been one of those, you know, not a prequel hater, but I've sort of been of the opinion that they really needed to tell the prequel sort of in, you know, from Palpatine's point of view. That was sort of the problem, is that, you know, in the original trilogy was, you know, told from Luke's point of view, even if it somehow eventually was sort of the redemption of Darth Vader or whatever. You know, the six films are the story of Darth Vader, but the original trilogy was the story of Luke Skywalker. I sort of contended that for the prequels are the story of Palpatine or the rise of the Empire. But now I finally understand that that's not what it is. The prequels are the tragedy of Padme Amidala. And just think about this. This episode, we see the fourth direct attempt to assassinate Padme. We had two in the movie, then we had assassins, and now we have this episode. She also has sort of two near-death experiences. and destroy Malevolence. She almost gets, captured and dies on the Malevolence. And then in Hoth's crisis where, she barely escapes the explosion in the Senate. So even though she's almost died five times, she's still traveling around without personal security. She really should be dead by now. And yet she's, but she's not. She's alive. And she, we know she's going to get pregnant or whatever. And the thing is that, Padme is a, very, opinionated, but she's very, honorable person. She fervently believes in the Republic and that we need to have the Republic. And she makes a lot of actions that have, when she was even the queen and now when she's in her, she's gotten a lot of enemies. And these enemies are trying to kill her. Yet somehow she survives. She's, she had five attempts here. She still has people out here trying to get her, probably more attempts. By surviving to the Revenge of the Sith, one, she brings about the downfall of the Republic when Anakin, basically because Anakin turns to the dark side to save her, we get the destruction of the Republic, and then she dies herself even. So, there's a lot more to go into. I won't go into that now, but that's it. Basically, the prequels is the tragedy of Padme Amidala. It all sort of makes sense to me. It all has fallen into place now. You had to come to this realization. And I sort of like that about that episode. That being said, I am still much more looking forward to what they talk about in next year with Savage Opress and the Dark Side and stuff about the Chosen One. Very much looking forward to next year. Still want to mind doing without all this stuff, but at least that's what it's on. This is why we've had all these politics. We now learn what the prequels are about, and it's very unclear necessarily what it's about, but that's my conclusion. And looking forward to Return of the Clone Wars in 2011.
All right. Thank you, Glenn.
I have to agree with Glenn. I think that, when you're watching the episode 3 commentaries and some of the back scenes and behind the scenes material, they even said that, they had to cut a lot of Padme's scenes to get to Anakin's story. Some of the Padme scenes where she's actually talking to Mon Mothma or other senators, and they're trying to develop this resistance within the Senate. They had to cut all that stuff out in order to have all of the beautiful lightsaber scenes we had, the half-hour lightsaber battles. So it makes sense that they would use this medium and this time period to tell, all of those stories of Padme's struggles, of the inside struggles, of trying to get bills passed and trying to get this war stopped from the inside. When Senate Spy came along, we were having a lot of Clone Wars episodes where it was a lot of fighting. And when we had a Senate Spy, we didn't have too much of the political intrigue of the behind-the-scenes stuff. And so it was a lot more exciting for me. But now we're seeing a lot of these stories, and it makes sense that they're doing it. But it's missing something.
I think, I agree with Barrett and Glenn on this. I think Padme is one of those characters that I always wanted to see do more, and I always felt like should be doing more since she's made out to be this really important character and then doesn't really get to do a whole lot. So getting to see her in action in her own arena, I feel like is really important and really gratifying. I can see where people will get tired of it week after week in a row, but I appreciate it. I like seeing it, and I do feel like it does give more depth to Luke and Leia, especially Leia, who kind of inherits that same diplomatic, political arena type personality that Padme does. So, yeah, I don't mind it. I really like to see it. Anything that gets Padme in the action, I actually really enjoy, because I feel like she's this great fiery character. She has so much passion, and she usually gets kind of shoved at the sidelines, which makes me sad. So I like this.
I'm not sure that we could necessarily call this the tragedy of Padme, per se. I think Barrent is right to the degree that here we are seeing stuff that is building up the Padme character, telling us what she's doing between episode 2 and episode 3, and it does feed into those scenes that were cut out of episode 3. We have the scenes with the different Republic senators who are trying to stop the war and all that kind of stuff, where we got a little bit more of how the rebellion must evolve out of Padme's efforts. But here's the thing. They were cut from the movie. If this was the tragedy of Padme, why would Padme have been given very, very little screen time and almost nothing to do in the final cut of Revenge of the Sith? She goes from being a strong young leader in The Phantom Menace to being a strong, active leader with aggressive negotiations in Episode 2 to being effectively the Star Wars equivalent of barefoot and pregnant in Episode 3. She does little to nothing in many respects within the context of Episode 3 other than playing a soundboard for other characters until the very end when she gives up the will to live with two babies being born. Yes, that's a tragic ending that she dies as a new mother whose children are still alive and now motherless, but it's made less tragic by the fact that they make it out to effectively be her choice, which I still don't buy, quite frankly. But you put that in the broader context of things, George Lucas has repeatedly said, over and over again, that whereas the classic mythological tropes are what we get out of the classic trilogy, that the prequel trilogy is effectively a tragedy in essentially a Greek or a classical type of sense, whether we're talking Greek, Roman, or other classical cultures like, you know, India that does the same general type of arcs when it comes to tragedy. And he even goes so far as to refer to things like, okay, we see Anakin in Episode 3 effectively making a pact with the devil. When asked by 60 Minutes ages ago about, well, does this go more biblical in a sense? He says, yes, absolutely. The last, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he flat out says the last scenes are going to take place on a lava world. He's literally going to hell to end this here. It's the story of Anakin. That's why we had to go back and see Anakin as a freaking 9 or 10 year old boy, depending on which source you're looking at. He basically has his birthday right around the time of The Phantom Menace. We see Anakin as a kid in Episode 1. We had to see the innocence building up to the tragedy of him. So yeah, it's a tragedy, but it's a tragedy of Anakin. Padme is brought along for the ride. That's like saying that the story of Hamlet is the tragedy of Ophelia. Well, yeah, tragic things happen to her, and tragic things happen within her life and her story arc within the play, but it's the tragedy of Hamlet. He's the star, he's the focus of the storytelling. And you can go back and look at George Lucas's stuff on the Bill Moyers Star Wars, or I think it's called Mythology in Star Wars, or Star Wars in Mythology, I forget what the name of it is, it's sitting in there on my DVD shelf. The special that Bill Moyers did with George Lucas talking about it, you can see excerpts from it actually on the Power of Myth that he did with Joseph Campbell. It's all this idea that this is a tragedy of Anakin Skywalker. And Padme, I think we can see the level of reverence that George Lucas had for Padme as a character, as a tragic character even, in how he treated her with Episode 3. He took her from being a strong female character to making her into almost a non-entity in Episode 3, except to be the thing that's driving Anakin. Rather than Anakin being the one propelling, in some ways, his own story. Anakin makes bad choices because of her, but she herself does extremely little while pregnant and running around with the Senate in Episode 3. So I do not buy this idea that this is a tragedy of Padme. She may be a tragic character, but the story being her tragedy, those are two very different things. And Lucas himself seems to be standing in direct opposition to that, saying it is Anakin's story. The Skywalker story, though you could call her a Skywalker, of course, but Anakin's story, Anakin's tragedy, likening Anakin to Hamlet, et cetera, et cetera. I do not buy that concept there. I totally agree that it's great to see more stuff for Padme, and she does have a tragic arc that's becoming more and more tragic as we see her making efforts that we know are going to fall flat over and over again, like the stuff in these three episodes. Absolutely. And it's good to see stuff coming back that gives us more oomph to those cut scenes that still appeared in the novel and such, to give us more of a sense of how the senators work against Palpatine and slowly lead up to the rebellion. But this is Padme's story? No. No way. Not going to happen. Not going to buy it. Because Lucas himself doesn't.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Now, before we sign off for the night, I'd like to go around and see what everybody thinks so far of this season. We're now at episode 11. The dead set halfway mark for season 3. We're about to break for a few weeks for the holidays, and then we're going to come back and continue season 3, or 3.5, as Nathan brought out. So, what do you guys think? How are we doing so far with season 3? Is this show pressing along, keeping its interest, or are we witnessing the fizzling out of the Clone Wars?
So far, I feel like the series has had some really, really good episodes, especially at the very beginning. I felt like it was really, really, the series was starting to hit its stride. But there have been a couple duds. I think with every series, there's going to be some duds. But for the most part, I feel like this has been more or less better than the last couple seasons. There's some stuff that I still have problems with, but I feel pretty positive on it so far. And seeing as we haven't seen much of anything that was shown at C5 yet, I'm hoping that the second half of this will be even stronger. So I'm looking forward to it. I don't feel like this has been a problem this season. I've been feeling positive on it.
I'm going to have to agree with Jen that I'm feeling pretty positive about the series. That, you know, we know what we're getting into every episode now. So it's kind of like, you know, we're not going to get Luke, I am your father every single episode. And if I go into expecting to see something like that, you know, I'm going to get disappointed. So I've kind of come to the realization that this is what it is. And it's not bad. We're getting good characters. We're getting good development. I mean, the animation is off the hook. There's nothing else out there like it. I'm reiterating, I am very excited about the Savage Opress coming forward. I mean, that has the potential of blowing up the Clone Wars to a whole new level with, you know, Savage Opress and, you know, who's going to train him and the dynamic between him and Dooku and Asajj. And so there's some pretty exciting things coming up. What is worrying me is that the last couple episodes, you know, I try to watch this with my son. He's 6 years old. He is not getting into this at all. You know, he cannot sit there and watch these debates go on over and over week after week. What's scaring me is that the viewers who this cartoon is actually, people are supposed to be watching it is children. And if they can't follow it, where are the ratings going to go? And no matter how good this show is, if the ratings aren't there, it's not going to be on the air. So that's my biggest fear, is that it's starting to disconnect from children. You know, it's very hard for them to follow. But for me, being an adult Star Wars fan, I'm very excited.
You know, I think I'm right there with Barrett when it comes to the issue of the tone of the series. It is a more adult season in a lot of ways. And unfortunately, that does seem like it is straying from its kid show roots. It seemed like early on the series sort of had an identity crisis going on. It wasn't sure if it wanted to be a more adult aim series or a more kid aim series in some of its episodes. Now it seems as though it is sort of settling into a much more adult pointed show. I mean, not adult oriented in a big sense, but certainly something that I could see children needing parts of it explained to them, and I could see adults getting more into the nuances of it, like the politics in this particular episode that had a little more layers to it than some of the other ones. But yeah, from the standpoint of its core audience, if the core audience is supposed to be children, I don't really see that happening. But then again, one of my favorite shows on TV right now is another Cartoon Network show, believe it or not. It's Tower Prep. And Tower Prep is a show that's on Cartoon Network, which is assumed to be a sort of kids show kind of network. And it's aimed at sort of younger audiences, maybe middle or high school. But I'm really getting into it. It's a really fun show. And it's the depth of conspiracies that's getting my attention. So I think sort of what we're seeing here is the Clone Wars is kind of going in a very similar direction. And maybe it's just that my perspective of what a kid's show is supposed to be versus what a kid's show is in this millennium, maybe I'm just not thinking of kid's shows the way that the developers of television series now think of kid's shows. Maybe it doesn't all have to be as goofy and crazy. I just finished watching the original Transformers series today, and there was more depth to that than I remembered. Maybe I'm just conceptualizing kid's shows differently than I should. Broadly speaking, though, this season is not as action-packed as the previous ones, really, and it's kind of overly political in a lot of ways. But even though it's been very chronologically inconsistent, bouncing all over the place, I think visually, I think in terms of solidity of episodes and not having a lot of really big bomb episodes that you just want to forget, this season has upped the bar from the previous two. A season that can make me respect and want to see more of Ahsoka has got to be a season that's doing something right. So kudos to Filoni and crew, because this season definitely has my attention, and I'm going to be waiting with bated breath to finally see the back half of the season and what they do with Savage, Tarjay, Opress, and some of these other directions that they're going. If this really is episodes coming in chronological order, presumably taking place after Senate murders into open territory, I'm psyched. Bring it on.
You know, I agree with you guys. This has been a great season. True, we've seen about as many political episodes in the first half of a season as we've seen in the entirety of past seasons. But all in all, this whole jumping around and wrapping up stories has worked for me. I really don't have as much to complain about it as some others on our forums and our voicemails have. Visually, it's very striking, and I'm looking forward to seeing where we go. If the second half of season three is going to be even better, then this is going to be a great second half. All right. Well, we've had a great first half of the season. Want to remind everybody that when we do come back in January, Clone Wars is getting moved up back to 8:30. Check your local listings. Also, if you haven't yet, stop over and download our special coverage of the Savage Opress event. And before we completely let you go, and speaking of things to check out online, our own Nathan P. Butler has a preview of his upcoming novella to tell us about.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I am writing books 1 and 5 out of a 9-book series that is tied into the Wars franchise. Not Star Wars, but Wars. When Decipher put out the Star Wars CCG and eventually lost the license and it moved over to Wizards of the Coast, they started up the Wars TCG, the Wars trading card game, which used a lot of the same mechanics, but has sort of this rich universe of stories all taking place within our solar system between 3 warring factions of humans and eventually a couple of alien races that come in by the time of the game. And we are working on a 9-book series of graphic novellas, that is, short novels with illustrations every few pages, about 10 illustrations, give or take, each, that are taking place about 3 years prior to the game during the lead-up to the events of what's called the Battle of Phobos, which is sort of a seminal moment in the history of that game. You can find out a lot more about it if you just go to YouTube and look up Wars Primer, or you go to GrailQuestBooks.com or check out my Facebook page. There's Primer videos up about it if you never heard of the series. But the cool thing is, the thing that you can check out online, is that if you go to GrailQuestBooks.com and look up the Wars series there, you'll find that when you pull up the page for Earther Novella Number 1, which is my first one, again, I'm doing 1 and 5, when you pull up that one, you'll find a short little 3-chapter preview from it that you can download as a PDF file. There's also an audio version that I put together that you can hear either by downloading it from there, subscribing to my other podcast, the Butlerniverse, which I hardly ever put out anything from anymore, but I put it into that feed there. Or if you pick up the December episode of my podcast, The EU Review from solosound.net, at the end of our, I think it's 12th regular episode, I'll be airing that audio preview there. So if you're interested in seeing where this is going, it's really kind of a cool franchise to get into, but it's something that not a lot of fans have really jumped into yet because it was something that came so far on the trails of Star Wars and a lot of people have forgotten about it. But it's being revved up again with novellas and a comic series all from Grail Quest Books that I'm really, really excited to be a part of. So check it out. And if you do check it out, drop me some feedback. You know, Nathan@StarWarsFanWars.com or catch me on Facebook, Twitter. I'd be really interested in hearing about what you people think, especially if you have been a player of the Wars game before. And thanks to Dan for giving me a chance to tell you guys a little bit about it.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. And also thank Barrett and Jen for being with me on this final episode of 2010. Hope everyone has a good break. And we will see everyone back here at the beginning of January. See what the rest of season 3 holds for us.
Bye, everybody. I hope everybody gets everything they want in Clone Wars merchandise for Christmas.
Have a good night.
Happy holidays, folks.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Barrent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Ingonza Media Incorporated, copyright 2010, all rights reserved.
You know, I wondered if you mentioned that I was filling in, if you wouldn't have just said anything, because I'm part of the crew. Nobody would even notice that I was gone. But yes, I'm back.
Everybody notices you're gone, Barrett.
Thank you. Boy Everest is back, y'all.
Boy Everest in the house. Stay on topic. Stay on topic. Baron, what did you think of Pursuit of Peace?
Hey. What? That's what I thought of it. Does that make any sense?
Let me rephrase that in a way that actually makes anything resembling sense.
Well, I was thinking about if this episode had been entitled Pursuit of Otherly Peace or Pursuit of Overall Peace, we could have called the episode Poop.
Well, with this episode in the, I almost said in the can, right after poop.
There you go. Yes.
Thanks, Nathan. Thank you very much.
Personally, yeah. When my wife listens to, you know, Republic 4, you've been on a lot, she really likes you being on there because it makes her feel like she's not a nerd. You know what I'm saying? So I had to put too much pressure on you.
That was, no, I don't know that came out like you wanted it to, Barrett.
I know what I said.
It's cool.
Good, I'm not the only one who's this about significance.
Oh my God. No, that's not what I meant.
Yeah, my wife's nothing like a nerd, Jen. You got that down.
Oh no, I'm a raging nerd. I fully admit it. I'm proud of it. It's okay.
I'm sorry. That's not what I meant.
No, that's funny. I love it. Don't worry.
No, that's not what I meant, Jen. I meant that she's a Star Wars person, you know, a woman. And it's just she likes when she hears another woman, you know, on there. So
right.
I was just thinking about the listeners.